I'm Reva Stout, and you're listening to A Therapist Can't Say That, the podcast where we talk about the things that it feels like a therapist can't say. Since my conversation with Hannah Baer, which you heard in my last episode about the Jewishness of therapy, I've been thinking about how interestingly and beautifully different that episode turned out to be than the one that I loosely envisioned when I first decided to do an episode on that topic. I started out from this place of first and foremost really wanting Jews to get the credit that we deserve for pioneering this field. Like any minority group, our contributions to things that society finds useful tend to be erased, subsumed into the machine of dominant culture, and homogenized as they are absorbed into its workings. I wanted the credit, and I wanted to take the Jewish ethnic identity of therapy back, to claim it. Hannah's article and my conversation with her helped me connect to something more than that, though, something that is more complex and interesting than simply therapy as a Jewish contribution to global culture, which it is, but about the particularities and nuances of the practice of therapy as something with Jewish qualities, something that we American Ashkenazi Jews might refer to as Yiddishkeit, a breath, a way of being, an essence that is Jewish. And some of the ways those essences manifest are articulable and describable, and I think Hannah and I did our best to articulate and describe them. And some of them are esoteric and mystical and inarticulable, the way the magic of therapy is itself esoteric and mystical and inarticulable. And the best we can do is gesture at them with words and hope that people look in the right direction and see what we are trying to point out. So the Yiddishkeit of therapy persists, despite the fact that it is rarely identified, recognized, or claimed, despite the permutations of therapy that have become something else entirely, whether that's, as Hannah said, the patented white Buddhism of DBT or the culturally and spiritually sterile short-term managed care style approach that looks more to me like case management than anything I recognize as therapy. The Jewish threads that have been a part of this work from the beginning are still there, waiting to be reknown, reclaimed, reseen, or not. That lineage is there, and we are a part of it, and it is a part of us, whether we choose or have the opportunity to recognize it or not. And so I've been thinking a lot about what it means to be part of a lineage. We don't really do lineages in America. Americanness itself is deeply intertwined with the fantasy of being self-made. And I think there is something even more potent about that particular quality of Americanness for those of us who live on the West Coast. If the North American continent is the place where Europeans flocked in order to attempt living the fiction of self-reinvention, then the West Coast is the place to which their descendants absconded for the same purpose. When the lineages and cultural bedrocks of the Eastern Seaboard became themselves too deeply entrenched. None of my four grandparents were born in this place we now call Portland, Oregon. This is where they ended up when they fled from the specter of the people they had been predestined to become. This is where, at long last, they stopped being Irish, German, Jewish. This is where, at long last, they became just American. Just white. As someone with a complex and often painful and disappointing relationship with my family of origin, I can't deny that there is something seductive about the fantasy of being self-made. There are shades of autonomy and freedom in it that are appealing. And yet those of us who have spent more than a few minutes here and there contemplating the American experiment in all its historical and geographical and sociological context know that the idea of being self-made is just that, a fantasy. We all come from somewhere, many of us a lot of somewheres, and we all come from someone, all of us a lot of someones. Our attempts to escape from that reality often come at our peril and the peril of others. Who we have been has an ineludible relationship with who we are to ourselves and who we are to each other. We participate in making ourselves, to be sure. When I have clients who excessively externalize their locus of control, I push them to internalize that hard. To own who we are is part of our birthright and responsibility as human beings, and we also belong to each other. We are made and unmade by each other and by the people who came before us. Those who we have known and those who we have not known, those whose names are famous and those whose names have long been lost in the river of deep time. What is my thesis here today? That history is important? That seems so banal. Put that way, no one would make the pretense of being able to reasonably disagree. Pull out that George Santayana quote about those who don't remember the past being condemned to repeat it, and everyone will nod along. But beyond the cliché of those kinds of statements, other than tut-tutting about the inadequacy of the American educational system, we don't often go very far into the brass tacks of what it means for history to matter, much less what it means for it to matter in a particular context, like a field of study or a field of practice. Think about it. When was the last time you had a conversation about therapy with a colleague that explicitly acknowledged something substantive and meaningful about its historical context? When was the last time you opened a therapy book from the last century, which, if I may remind you, was a mere 25 years ago? My guess is that a lot of you will have a hard time answering those questions. I recently saw a post on Instagram criticizing Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, on the basis that it's dated. That book was published in 2014. Far be it for me to object to critique of Bessel van der Kolk. There's no shortage of things to critique about his work, and in fact, you will hear my guest and I diving into a pretty specific critique of that book in my next episode. But dated isn't it. And the fact that somebody felt perfectly comfortable hopping onto a social media platform and telling their large following that the problem with the therapy book from 10 years ago is that it's dated speaks so much to what I'm trying to point at here about our fractured and uninterrogated relationship to our histories. Ahistoricism is in the air we breathe. It's in the water we drink. Ahistoricism is part of the gravitational pull that binds us to this culture. We have to actively resist it, push against it, to avoid being moved by it, to avoid having it do its death-dealing work of dissolution through us. It feels especially strange to be making the case for the importance of history in the context of a field that was originally predicated on just that, that our histories shape us in deeply embedded ways that are worth working to understand. This is a field established on the premise that history matters. But more and more often, I find myself having to make just that case. If you've been to as many trainings on trauma modalities as I have over the years, you will start to notice a theme. No matter the modality or approach, no matter whether the framework explicitly makes use of the client's historical content or not, the trainer will tell you at some point that trauma work is not really about the past, it's about the present. Now, on some level, it seems like this should be so self-evident that it doesn't bear saying. Clients come to us because they are seeking to mitigate their suffering. The therapeutic endeavor is to substantively effectuate that, and of course, suffering can only be mitigated in the present. So to say that any therapy is about the present seems obvious and true enough by the very nature of the project itself. But my impression is that contemporary therapists are generally so jumpy about being associated with the image of therapy as sitting together and excavating the client's past that there has emerged this need to disclaim that image by calling the therapy present-centered, even in cases of modalities where a bulk of the therapy does involve some permutation of sitting together and excavating the client's past. Why are we so eager as a collective to dissociate ourselves from that and from the value of that? It can't be because it particularly doesn't work. Remember, as I am very fond of pointing out on this show, the research emphatically does not find any particular modality to be meaningfully more effective than any other modality, and that includes psychoanalysis. I personally think that it is more likely that it is because we are collectively part of a culture that fears and repudiates the past, that we have all drunk deeply from the well of forgetting that is American ahistoricism and been thoroughly indoctrinated, despite many of our efforts to the contrary, into the cult of the next big thing. So I find myself having to make the case, then, that history matters, that the past matters. And of course, one of the reasons that it does is because the idea of a past and present itself is in many ways a false binary. The concepts of past and present, of course, have utility, but we are not just who and where and how we are right now. We are the accumulation of everything that has ever happened that has brought us to this split second in time, and the next, and so on. As people are fond of quoting William Faulkner as saying, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." Or, as people are less fond of quoting, but I think they should be more fond of quoting because it's fantastic, "The past is not done and it is not over. It's still in process." Which is another way of saying that when it's critiqued, analyzed, it yields new information about itself. The past is already changing as it is being re-examined, as it is being listened to for deeper resonances. Actually, it can be more liberating than any imagined future if you are willing to identify its evasions, its distortions, its lies, and are willing to unleash its secrets. That's Toni Morrison. To make that case, I'm going to return to the question I posed a few minutes ago about what it means to be part of a lineage, and what it means to be part of a lineage in this work. I've said before that, to me, to be a therapist means to be part of a siblinghood. And if we are evoking that image of a family system, to be part of a siblinghood means you also, somewhere down the line, have parents. So that's a fucking mixed bag, am I right? We have progenitors in this work, and they are more than Wikipedia articles or chapters in theory textbooks that you haven't opened since graduate school. To be part of a lineage, whether that's biological, cultural, ideological, professional, or otherwise, means being in relationship with people who came before you, whether you choose to be and whether you like it or not. That is the reality that contrasts to the American fantasy of being self-made, self-invented. The word lineage sounds sort of grand, doesn't it? Like one step down from the word dynasty. But the reality of both lineages and dynasties is that they're messy, like all realities. And one of my deep beliefs that informs the way that I do this work in general is that we can only organize messes to the extent that we can at all by engaging with them consciously. Otherwise, we just act them out. And yes, that's very psychoanalytic. I'm really leaning into it over here these days. We can be in relationship with our lineages unconsciously, or we can be in relationship with them consciously to a certain extent. Not being in relationship with them at all is not an option. More specifically than the question of what it means to be part of a lineage, I am interested in the question of what it means to be in relationship with that lineage in a substantive and meaningful way. Being in meaningful relationship with our collective lineage in this work has to involve more than just deciding what parts of it we do and don't like. And I think perhaps part of the problem of superficiality in relationship to our professional lineages in this work is that deciding what we do and don't like is kind of where most of us usually stop. And to be clear, I am not putting down that kind of discernment and critique. It's important. There are plenty of things in the lineage of our field that I don't like. I don't like that it is a part of the lineage of therapy to have institutionalized queer people for being queer. I don't like that it is a part of the lineage of therapy to have pathologized Black people for resisting segregation. I don't like that it is a part of the lineage of therapy to have treated women whose lives under patriarchy were driving them crazy as though they were themselves just crazy. It's important to see the things in our lineages that we don't like, acknowledge them, and identify them as such. This is pretty fucking basic. And if you haven't even scratched the surface of that kind of engagement with our lineages yet, that is a good place to start. However, it is not a very good place to finish. A minute ago, I said that to be part of a lineage means being in relationship with people who came before you, whether you choose to be and whether you like it or not. The therapists who participated in doing the things that I just described, I am in relationship with them whether I like it or not. And as stated, I don't. I could theoretically opt out of this relationship by choosing to no longer be a therapist, and I know that on the far left of critique of this field, there are therapists or former therapists who are choosing to do that, and that's fine. I personally am a therapist down to my bones, and I'm going to be here until I die or they fucking kick me out of here, because I obviously believe therapy has value, and I assume you do too if you're here with me listening. So I am here. And I am part of this lineage where I am in some sort of relationship with people who have done atrocious things under the auspices of this practice we call therapy. And I would posit that there is something more interesting to be learned from those relationships than simply disavowing those people, which again, to be clear, I also do. There is something about the opportunity being part of a lineage gives us to contend with the full spectrum of humanity, including the really fucking ugly parts. And we all individually contain that full spectrum of humanity within us. We all have the capacity to commit atrocities. We all have the capacity to abuse power. We all have the capacity to do harm in the name of our ideologies, values, and belief systems, even if we go around driven by the idea that we want to help people. That is disquieting, but true. And there is something about that, that these relationships with the people we don't want to have relationships with in our lineages, that can teach us about that, perhaps in a more specific and grounded way than just the abstract knowing that it is true. But I really specifically don't want to only focus on the monstrous stuff, because focusing too tightly on that creates another place where we become susceptible to the pull of ahistoricism. If we only look at the aspects of our lineages that are ugly, we can succumb to that tendency that I am particularly trying to advocate against, where we try and just flush all that history down the toilet and look for the next big thing, or the lefty version of that, the next big non-problematic thing, which is never going to exist in perfect form, so we might as well stop trying to get there by discarding everything that has come before us wholesale. Critique does not have to mean annihilation, and valuing our histories does not necessitate hero worship. Being part of a lineage means that we have the opportunity to be in conversation with more people than we can currently access. Because we are already in relationship with our forebears in this work, whether we like it or not, to reach back consciously into the history of this field and engage with their ideas means that we are joining in, responding to a conversation that was initiated with us before we even showed up here. To be able to engage in that kind of conversation with intention and specificity and clarity is part of the beauty of the written word, that no living person need even be holding the other end of the conversation in their mind for you to be a part of it. Although they probably are, there are people carrying all sorts of ancient and obscure threads forward in this work without you knowing about it, which is also pretty cool. The foundational perspective of therapy is that something important and transformational happens when we are in dialogue with each other that cannot happen when we are alone. And the advantage of being part of a lineage is that it expands those opportunities for dialogue exponentially across time and space, into the past and into the future, with those who have not yet shown up here. Engaging in the conversation with our historical forebears gives us the opportunity to recontextualize a lot of the contemporary thought in our field that seems new and shiny, but is really closer to a recapitulation or a reimagining of old ideas. Open Many, a recently published therapy book, and if you're well versed in the history of theory and practice in our field, you'll see a lot of pretty familiar concepts with some fresh ornamentation and shine added to them. And that's not a bad thing, actually. Remember, newer is not better, and old ideas don't need to sit in a proverbial museum case, unmodified and unengaged with, collecting dust. Would I like to see more contemporary authors acknowledge their historical influences to make explicit reference to the lineage of ideas in this work? Sure, definitely. But repackaging and expanding on old ideas is not the problem. It's part of the beauty of being situated in a lineage. Our history gives us material to innovate with, and we create new delivery systems for that material that are appropriate to the setting of our contemporary cultures, using the languages of meaning-making that resonate with people now. Being part of a lineage and getting to know that lineage also gives us a window into what seems to be unchangeable about our work, the existential qualities of it. What are the things that therapists have always struggled with? The compulsion, the calling, the feeling bound to this work, the simultaneous loneliness and beauty of having so many of one's intimate relationships take place inside the small and dense container, the sensation of having a split life, the two halves of which cannot be reconciled, the social alienation of having a backdoor view into the dark realities of human suffering, difficult clients who don't get better no matter what you try, who make you think, if I just had the right key, there must be something out there that is the right key. These themes, and more of the existential themes we therapists have in common, are all over the historical literature. There is a sadness in that, in the reality that those struggles don't really get resolved. And there is also the beauty of camaraderie there, in the recognition that these are just some of the burdens that we carry and have always carried in this, what we call, for lack of a better fucking word, profession. Burdens get a bad rap because, I suppose, by their nature, they are heavy and hard to carry. But they are perhaps less heavy when we know that we are carrying them together and when we know that others have carried them before and that others still will pick them up when we lay them down. For me, of course, as you know, if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, contending with our professional lineage also means contending with my actual biological lineage, my family. As a young 20-something, I tried to get away from the family business, but ultimately couldn't resist its pull. And yes, I've made the just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in joke many a time. I was shaped to be this before I was ever conceived of. And then before I was old enough to know what being a therapist was or have words for it. I've made my peace with that, with the way I am an accumulation of my family's histories, living out those histories in this very specific way. My understanding of this particular thread of my personal and professional history, my therapist origin story, starts on a ship leaving port from Istanbul, heading to Canada in 1919. My great-grandmother Riva, for who I am named, has just walked there from St. Petersburg, Russia, carrying my infant grandfather. Her husband and my great-grandfather, an anarchist, yes, it seems to run in the family, has just been murdered by Soviet hardliners in a political dispute. My great-grandmother and my infant grandfather make it across the ocean, huddling together in the lower deck of the ship. He feels the grief in every cell in her body, feels how he cannot cure it, even though both of them long for him to. Overland, they make it to the beating Yiddish heart of early 20th century Brooklyn. At night, boarding with another family while his mother attends college, my grandfather strokes his hair in the darkness, pretending his own hand is his mother's. 64 years after my grandfather, I was born in the comparatively miraculous safety and prosperity of the West Coast of the United States of America, an English-speaking white only daughter of relatively well-to-do suburban professionals. On the face of it, my story is not much like his. But when I seek conversation with it, when I seek dialogue with him, dead though he has been these past 23 years, I find familiarity. All our therapist origin stories start with something like my grandfather's, some absence and some longing, mine and yours too, listener, if you look for it. That is part of the wonder of this lineage too, that in this absence and in this longing, we can find kinship with one another. That is what being part of a lineage allows us to do if we seek it. It is a little strange finding myself telling stories like these, the stories of my family. As you get older, the stories you once were told become the stories you tell. You become the person who is left to tell them. As most of the members of the older generations of my family have died over the past few years, That is a part of being in a lineage that I have started to learn something about. The stories of my family are increasingly mine to tell. I may not get all the details right. In fact, I almost certainly won't. And I may not make the same meanings of those stories that my ancestors would have. That too seems certain. But that's okay. The meanings of the stories that we find in our lineages are not somewhere else out there. They're not to be found. They're to be made. The meanings, after all, are not in the heavens. They're here, on Earth, with us. Thank you for being here on A Therapist Can't Say That. If you're enjoying the show, please rate, review, and follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to share the show with a therapist friend who you know really wants to join us in talking about the things it feels like a therapist can't say. As always, you can find me, Reva Stout, at intothewoodsportland.com and now also at thekilnschool.com. I love hearing your thoughts, feedback, critiques, complaints, compliments, suggestions, and of course your A Therapist Can't Say That moments. Feel free to reach out to me via email or sending me a voice note to Reva at intothewoodsportland.com. Talk to you next time.